I'm going to start this around.
Some pictures.
Hi, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving.
Hi.
I'm Lisa. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi.
I wanted to start by giving thanks to Mary L. and Judith B. for giving me the opportunity to speak with you all this evening. This is the first time I've ever shared my story. I'm very nervous, and knowing that when I'm very nervous, I do not speak very effectively out of my head. I will be relying a lot on my notes, but my higher power told me you all would understand. So I'm going to get started. To qualify, I attended my first OA meeting on November 8th, 2015, so I've been in the program for a little over 2 years. I've been abstinent from binge eating and sneak eating for 574 days, including today, one day at a time. I've released 30% of my body weight, maintaining a 50-pound weight loss from my peak weight of 165. And for context, I'm 5'2". A little family history. I was born in Princeton, New Jersey. I have one sibling. She's a sister, 5 years older than me. My father is a kind-hearted but emotionally distant man. My mother is insecure, high anxiety, perfectionistic, suspicious of others, hypercritical, emotionally unavailable, compulsive, and food-obsessed. I was just like her until I started to change here in OA. My parents placed great emphasis on performance and achievement in arts, sports, and academics. Nothing was ever done for sheer enjoyment's sake, and no performance I gave in any arena was ever good enough, particularly for my mom. While I had a handful of close friends at school, I always felt very socially awkward and insecure. Overall, I was a compliant kid. I did what I was told, and I tried not to need anything. But I did need things, as it turned out. I needed some space to just relax and have fun and not take things so seriously. I needed to feel that I was good enough as a person, regardless of my particular performance in an activity. And I needed to feel comfortable and accepted by my family and my peer group. It is within this context that my compulsive behavior began. Rather than face my social anxiety, my deep-rooted sense of inadequacy, my stress from being overscheduled, and other negative feelings head-on, I buried them deep in denial. Nothing to see here. Everything is fine. But everything wasn't fine. I believe that I unintentionally developed compulsive behaviors to help me manage my anxiety in order to function. The pressures of daily living would build up, and I would relieve the pressures with food. I would repeat the same vicious cycle again and again. Binge eating and weight gain would be followed by regret and self-recrimination, leading to dieting, excessive exercise, and weight loss, then backsliding to binge eating. My first binge was around age 13. My sister had just gone off to college, so when I got home from school, I was alone in the house until my parents got home from work. I came to relish this alone time with my food. During this first binge, I ate an entire loaf of bread straight out of the bag while standing at the refrigerator, watching out the window, ready for my mom's car to pull into the driveway. The next day, when my mom went to make her lunch, she discovered there was no bread. She asked if I had eaten it. I lied and said, I may have had a couple of slices. She remarked that, you know, I must have had more than that because we have no bread. And I proposed that maybe my father had eaten it, or that maybe we hadn't had as much as she had remembered. She shook her head in disbelief, but then dropped it. The lesson I took away from this experience was that I needed to spread my eating around so she wouldn't notice that things were missing. So I strategically dabbled in bread, crackers, chips, cereal, cheese, peanut butter, ice cream, maple syrup, and my favorite, brown sugar. I ate all foods straight from their containers while standing in the kitchen, ready to toss the package of whatever I was eating back in the cupboard the second someone came home. The disorder of compulsive overeating is progressive. As I got older and gained more independence, my eating only got worse. What started as a maladaptive coping mechanism developed into a deeply entrenched habit. I no longer needed a reason to binge. I just found myself eating or thinking about eating all the time. During a binge, I felt as if I'd been taken over by outside forces. I was asleep at the wheel, and my body was running on autopilot. I wasn't making bad choices. I was making no choices. I was living without intention, merely reacting to life hastily, recklessly, without purpose or consideration for anyone or anything. I started getting to school early just to get donuts at the cafeteria before class. Mind you, this is after having eaten breakfast at home. As a high school senior, I would drive to Burger King for lunch and then hit the 7-Eleven on the way back to school to grab a muffin or some ho-hos to sneak eat during class. My best friend in high school was also my binge buddy. Her parents would go away for the weekend, and I'd stay over for all-night food fests, eating pizza, chips, cookie dough, and ice cream until we were literally so ill we couldn't continue. In our senior yearbook, we dedicated the same quote to each other, "Diet starts Monday." When I got to college, I was faced with more anxiety, more freedom, and more food. I would routinely leave class to go to the dining hall for the all-you-could-eat buffet. I would go alone just before the cafeteria shut down between meals, where there'd be fewer people to observe me gorging myself. Already overweight at the end of high school, I gained 30 pounds during my first year of college. After college, I started traveling on business. If I was traveling by car, I would pull off at every highway exit to replenish my food supply for the trip back home, lying to my husband that the journey took longer than expected because of traffic. If my trip was further away, I'd binge at the airport, on the airplane, in my hotel room, and in the car on my way back home. The more alone time I had, the more I ate. The duration of any period of binge eating would vary, separated by periods of extreme dieting and exercise. Before my wedding, I did the Atkins diet for 9 months, and because I really wanted to be thin for the event, I cut out nearly all carbohydrates entirely, not reintroducing certain types of carbs as you're meant to do. I lived on meat, cheese, pork rinds, and sugar-free Jell-O. In the album that's going around, there's actually two pictures of me taken years apart, sitting in front of a bowl of red Jell-O. The impact on my digestive system was dramatic during these 9 months of Atkins dieting. Mind you, I didn't follow the actual diet's plan, but rather I did it my way, which is always better. I may have spent a lot of time in the bathroom during those 9 months, but I was indeed a thin bride. Immediately following the wedding, I binged my way through Ireland on our honeymoon and continued nonstop for the first few years of our marriage. My rock bottom came when I had a "how did I get here" moment about the level of deception I would perpetrate to get food. This incident was particularly upsetting to me because I thought I had my eating under control at the time. I was at that time maintaining a normal weight and keeping my fluctuations between 10 and 15 pounds instead of the 30 to 50 pounds that I had swung from to and from in the past. I work out with a master swim team that practices on Wednesday nights. On one such night, I packed my swim bag as usual, but in addition to my cap and goggles, I stowed a spoon from my kitchen. I said goodbye to my husband as usual, drove up Queen Anne Hill as usual. Then instead of going to swim practice, I parked at the Safeway, bought a can of chocolate frosting, walked across the street to the Starbucks, ordered a hot chocolate, had a donut while I waited for my drink. Then I sat and ate a can of frosting, concealed in a brown paper bag, with the spoon I had brought from home, as I read a book by the fireplace. At the time swim practice was scheduled to end, I went into the Starbucks bathroom, soaked my bathing suit in the sink, wet my hair, drove home, hung up my wet bathing suit as usual, and told my husband I had a good workout with the team. For some reason, this incident finally woke me up long enough to see that this craziness must stop. But I knew from experience that I was powerless to help myself. I wasn't yet in OA, but I had unknowingly taken step one. As I said, the disease is progressive. Untreated, it just gets worse and worse and eventually can lead to death. But the good news is recovery is progressive as well, and it just keeps getting better and better. I finally realized that I had a problem beyond my weight. I sought therapy from a psychologist and was diagnosed with binge eating disorder.
Duh.
Therapy provided me a lot of self-knowledge. I gained a better understanding of the root causes of my problems. I even managed to stop binge eating for about 5 months. But as it says in the big book, willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. And before long, I had started up again. The strange mental twist led me back to compulsive eating, and I was off to the races once more. Complaining to my therapist about the cost of her sessions, especially considering I was still binge eating, she suggested I join her own group sessions, which were less expensive. The mention of group therapy jogged a memory about the existence of OA. I don't recall where I had originally heard of it, but looking on the internet, I saw there were meetings in my area, and it was free! So I quit therapy and went to my first OA meeting. At my first meeting, addiction shifted to recovery. When the speaker said, "You're not alone anymore. Welcome to Overeaters Anonymous. Welcome home," I cried, as I almost might right now. And back then, I never cried because I had no feelings or emotions that I ever expressed. I heard my story in the words of other members, and I knew that I had found my people. I figured if these people had suffered in the same way I had, but worked this program and felt better, then maybe if I did what they suggested, I could feel better too. And that hope kept me coming back. There are several paradoxes within this program. One that enabled me to make progress in my recovery is surrender to win. I had to surrender to meetings, to my sponsor's advice, to working the steps, to turning things over to God, to giving service to others, to turn my life around. Surrender in this context implies enlightenment, not defeat. I learned that I could tap into the power of the program so long as I kept in fit spiritual condition. So how did I get spiritually fit? I kept coming back, participating in 2 in-person meetings a week, supplemented with phone meetings and OA podcasts. I got a sponsor within the first month of joining OA. We spoke on the phone every day. I texted her my food every night. With her general guidance, I developed my own plan of eating. She encouraged me to practice morning quiet time, to make outreach calls, to write about what I'm grateful for in moments of self-pity. Most importantly, my sponsor and I started working the 12 steps together right away. I don't have time to cover all of my step work here in detail, but I'll share a few highlights. As a diehard atheist, step 2, came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, was a real tough pill for me to swallow. I thought I might just skip that part. But you can't effectively work this program without some concept of higher power as you understand him or her or it. Part of my growth includes not getting hung up on vocabulary. For instance, I claim to have a spiritual program, but I don't believe in spirits per se. We use terms like God, higher power, and spirituality within these rooms so that we're speaking a common language. But our program gives us the freedom to define these terms in a very personal way. I've adopted the God as acronym approach, G-O-D, standing for Good Orderly Direction. While I don't believe in any supernatural forces, my personal philosophy now incorporates a trust in an inner wisdom forged through millennia of evolution, a power greater than myself, that ensures our survival as a species and provides me the direction I need for a sane life. Another OA paradox that hit me as I worked the steps is suffer to get well. I had to suffer through my disease, hit my personal bottom, and then feel emotional pain, really feel the pain, particularly when working steps 4, 5, and 9 in order to get well. All the steps contributed to my recovery, but step 9 was particularly impactful. Though the process of making amends to those I had wronged, through that process, I began healing festering wounds, repaired broken relationships, lightened the weight on my shoulders, and lessened my isolation. In making amends, we can't control how others will react to us. I have not yet received forgiveness from the person closest to me and can't know if this mercy will ever come. But we're working on it, getting more open and honest with each other, and the program helps support me through these difficult times without eating. Remember that to amend something means to change it, to make it better. Step 9 is not just about saying, I'm sorry, and seeking forgiveness, though that's part of it. It's about becoming a different person and growing along spiritual lines. Thank you. So let me tell you how I am now compared to the way I was before OA. I am coming closer to that person I want to be with each passing day, but twisted thinking, compulsivity, and character defects do not vanish overnight. My whole attitude and outlook on life has changed. I know a new freedom and a new happiness. Fears, resentments, and regrets have lessened to a point where I'm at peace most of the time. Feelings of uselessness and self-pity have largely disappeared. I am less interested in selfish things and am gaining an interest in my fellows. I generally feel that I'm at a place of neutrality concerning food. I don't battle mental obsession, nor do I worry about ridding my life of triggers. I feel safe and protected, and this has happened automatically, which is the miracle of working the steps. On the rare occasion that I am tempted, I panic for a moment. Then I use my willpower to pause and ask my higher power for an intuitive thought or direction, thy will, not mine, be done. I can strive towards the ideals promised in the big book, but I will never be perfect because I'm human. And while I will never be cured of compulsivity, I can have a daily reprieve so long as I keep in fit spiritual condition. So what does my spiritual fitness regimen look like? After thoroughly working steps 1 to 9 with my sponsor, I continue to work steps 10, 11, and 12 daily because I can't stay clean today on yesterday's shower. My daily step 10, continue to take personal inventory. I keep an eye out for fresh resentments, fears, and wrongs against others, which I work through using the same methodology as in step 4. I identify the cause, the part of myself that is affected, and my contribution to the situation. If I need to make an amends, I do that. If not, I turn things over to HP and my sponsor. I also consider my plan of eating as part of my daily step 10 work, keeping a food journal as a component of my personal inventory. I track what I eat on a weighed and measured food plan, which keeps me honest and accountable. It gives me the mental freedom to know I'm not incrementally slipping back into overeating. My daily step 11. Each day starts with morning meditation consisting of the 3 R's of recovery, reading, writing, and reflection. I read program literature for about 5 to 10 minutes and the On Awakening passage from the Big Book. I ask God to direct my thinking, particularly that it be motivated by loving kindness, gratitude, honesty, and generosity. Then I reflect and write about the 24 hours ahead, paying particular attention to how my character defects have derailed me in the past during similar events and how I will deliberately act in a manner aligned with God's direction. During this portion of my meditation, I literally pull out my calendar to see what I have planned, and I write about how I can be most effective at each meeting, including how I'll interact with the specific people on my calendar. Each day ends with a quick mental review of my day. I ask myself if there's anything I could have done differently, and if so, I make changes going forward. My daily step 12. Another OA paradox is relevant here. I must keep it, give it away to keep it, give it away to keep it. For me, that means I attend and share at meetings, talk with newcomers, make outreach calls, hold a service position, and sponsor someone that's still suffering. In closing, I'll leave you with one last paradox. Die to live. The old me, the selfish, self-pitying, arrogant, fearful, deceitful, sick me, had to die so that I could be reborn into an existence built on physical, emotional, and spiritual health. Before OA, I couldn't see the fabulous possibilities of life, love, health, success, strength, purpose, and fun, because I blocked myself from the sunlight of the spirit with a mountain of Oreos. Early in my recovery, I cried at a meeting because I feared that without binge eating, I'd never again feel comfort and relief. What I've learned since then is that the relief I used to get from food now comes from the fellowship itself, and without the soul-crushing imprisonment of excess weight, shame, and isolation. Longtime members don't keep coming back because they're still obsessed with food. They keep coming back because they're still human and still have uncomfortable and painful emotions that need to be dealt with. And this program gives them a healthy and effective system for acting on life rather than reacting to it. I am living proof that freedom from food obsession, binge eating, chronic dieting, purging, excessive exercise is possible. But none of this is automatic. I must be willing to live the 12 steps daily to practice these principles in all my affairs in order to keep my recovery, because that's what it means to go to any length. The path is simple, but not easy. No matter what, I know I'm not alone in this journey, as you all have given me the gift of acceptance that I've craved my whole life. Thanks for letting me share. Happy Thanksgiving.